We talk about how much money we spend. We don't talk at all as much as we should about what we spend it on. So what are the big aims we want to achieve? How do we achieve them? What is effective aid? But what we do know from a big body of research is that there is a lot of aid that is extremely effective. And we also know that at top level, there is a robust relationship between development assistance and economic development.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
It should come as no surprise to you that the global development domain is currently facing huge challenges. Apart from trying to stimulate economic growth and ensuring a fair distribution of the benefits of that growth, national governments and their international partners must also tackle complex conflicts, provide humanitarian assistance, and not least address the harmful impacts of climate disruption. What then should the role of external actors be in addressing all of these huge challenges? How can so-called good intentions be best mobilized into effective actions on the ground? These questions have been asked for a long time now, and yet I often hear a common complaint when I interact with policymakers in the Global South. Some of them claim that their international partners are often better at preaching than listening. When reflecting on the role of UN organizations and bilateral aid agencies in his country, an official in Ethiopia recently told me, I quote, "We should choose what we want. You should not choose what we want," end quote. But it is not just recipients of aid that are highlighting this power imbalance. Even international agencies recognize that something is not working. And so in December 2022, a group of donors issued a joint statement on supporting locally led development, where they pledged to pursue actions to foster locally sustained change that is tied to each country's unique context and based on three core principles. First, shifting and sharing power to ensure local actors have ownership over and can meaningfully and equitably engage in development, humanitarian, and peace-building programs. Second, work to channel high-quality funding as directly as possible to local actors, while at the same time ensuring mutual accountability for the effective use of funds and the management of risks. And third, publicly advocate for locally led development using the convening authority and the partnerships and networks of donor countries and agencies. To discuss this renewed interest among aid agencies to advance locally led development, I'm joined by Håvard Nygård, who is a Deputy Director General of the Norwegian Agency for Development Cooperation, NORAD, where Håvard directs the Department of Knowledge. Until a few years ago, he was research director at the Peace Research Institute Oslo, PRIO, where his research focused on armed conflict and political violence, peace building, and patterns of democratic development. In this conversation, Håvard and I discuss what partnership for locally led development really means, the current discourse on aid effectiveness, debates on how we should evaluate what works in global development, and of course, the future of aid. Please remember to hit the subscription button to ensure that all episodes are automatically downloaded on your device. Please also rate my show on your preferred platform, as it will help us reach newer audiences. Thank you, and I hope you're enjoying season 4. It's lovely to see you, Håvard. Welcome to the basement.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Is there a difference between the term foreign aid and what you guys at NORAD talk about, which is more development cooperation. Is that like a more politically correct word these days? I know it's been used for a while, but what is the scene at the moment? Is it more correct to say cooperation than aid?
First of all, thank you. Thank you for having me, Dan. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast. It's kind of interesting. We still use the word bistand in Norwegian, which directly translates to aid.
Yeah.
But when we talk about Norwegian aid, quote unquote, internationally, it's always now development cooperation. And the, you know, the general thinking is that aid was something we gave to them. But development cooperation is something we do together, very much in the spirit of the of sustainable development and all of that. So a part of this is politically correct. Part of it is maybe even a little woke. But I think there's also, it has interesting nuances because it's not just we giving money to poorer countries. It is a joint effort for sustainable development. So that's why development cooperation is a more fitting term some of the time.
Right. But I'm thinking also how in the last few years, many countries are saying that for this to be truly equal, the partnership, we have to have other people, other countries, other actors should be able to influence the policy process. And the fact of the matter, and I'd like to hear your views on this, Håvard, is that whatever we give in terms of aid or development cooperation comes, of course, from the taxpayer, say here in Norway. And there is often this feeling that the money we give should reflect our values. So there is always, as I see it, some sort of an implicit conditionality. It's not based on what others necessarily only want. It's also shaped increasingly, in fact, quite a lot by what we consider to be important. And that creates, I suppose, this tension between the term aid and cooperation.
We've been on a tour this year throughout several of our partner countries, African countries, talking about the future of development aid and to hear their views. You know, what should the future of development aid or future of development cooperation look like? There's a few very interesting things that come out of that. So when you ask, you know, leading thinkers in countries like Uganda, Ghana, Kenya, what they think should be the basis or the, you know, the integral parts of development assistance, there's a few things that we don't do anymore that they have very high up on their list. So for instance, Norway hardly does any direct budget support anymore. Mm-hmm. It used to be that a big part of our aid and a big part of many countries' aids were basically giving money directly to other country state budgets. We don't do that at all anymore. If you ask Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Planning, leading economic thinkers in countries like Ghana, they will say, please bring back but direct budget support. We stopped doing that for, you know, various reasons. One particularly important that it was too sensitive, right? Because you to some extent, you are then responsible for whatever that country does. And I think that's this is an interesting dilemma because on the one hand, the countries want direct budget support. The research base, the knowledge base for budget support is solid. It's very effective development aid. According to DFID or FCDO, it's a so-called best buy for economic development. But we don't do it anymore for domestically political reasons, right? Yeah. And that is a fundamental dilemma, right, of development cooperation. It is, as you say, our money. It is taxpayer money that is supposed to help other countries on their terms. And we know, right, one of the so-called effectiveness principles that the global aid community has agreed on is that aid should be locally led. And we all agree that aid should be locally led. But there's a limit to that, right? When it crashes with our political priorities, then our political priorities win the day and locally led has to take a back seat.
And that is exactly the tension I see, you know, because we can say that we can consult others, etc. But at the end of the day, there are political constraints, there are other issues. So one thing I thought of when you were saying that the Ugandans were talking about budget support, another thing that we don't do these days is infrastructure, which is where the Chinese have excelled of late, particularly on the African continent. You went on this tour
What else did they say, apart from, say, budget support? What else did they say that your partners there in many of these countries, your partner countries, what did they want from you that you were not doing anymore, apart from budget support? Is there anything else? Is it about money always, or is it about the sectors that should be prioritized?
It's about the sectors, and it's also about, you know, our aims and our priorities. I think there are, so we have a lot of issues that we want to pursue in when we do development cooperation, important issues related to human rights, equality, these things that are integral to our way of thinking sustainable development. From the point of view of many developing countries, a more primary concern is economic transformation, economic development. And I think there's to some extent, there's a sense that we sometimes don't have our priorities straight. And then, you know, we would, I guess, argue about the what are the factors that lead to sustainable development. We're going to argue that these factors, human rights, etc., are integral to sustainable development. But that creates, you know, tensions, and it creates interesting dilemmas. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of people that work in the Norwegian aid sector are fundamentally deeply motivated to do their job by, you know, they want to improve other countries. They want to help other people. That's their motivation. That's why they joined the effort. That's why they took the job, and that's what motivates them every single day. But at the end of the day, we don't answer to the people of Uganda, right? We answer to the MFA, exactly, which answers to the parliament, which answers to the Norwegian taxpayers. That's the chain of command, whether we like it or not. And that's always going to be an inherent tension for the aid as a industry, and also for everyone who works in this system.
Yeah, I think that is a very good point, because that leads me to this issue of what is effective aid. We could have, and we do have, situations where certain things are known to work because we academics have done research and we think it's a rigorous study. There's sound evidence. Just to give example of what you just mentioned, the budget support. I mean, if DFID says, or FCDO has found that it is a great intervention, there are all of these reasons why we stopped doing it. As you were saying, that, well, we can't hold them to account. The money will just disappear in the government coffers. Mm. But some of the best or the most convincing argument for budget support is that one boosts the legitimacy of the state, right? It is not about getting the NGOs more recognition, or Norway or the development partner donor country more recognition. You're strengthening, in some cases, a weak state, a fragile state. But the flip side is, of course, that some of this money can end up in the wrong priority areas, and there may be a corruption scandal, and then it's more difficult for the donor to justify. But returning to the idea, or the fact, I suppose, that many of the people working like you in the system are motivated, how does one tackle then this dilemma that there may be certain things that are known to work and yet one can't do these things? Is there a way around to this?
That is a good question. So I think, you know, on the one hand, we take the issue of locally led development extremely seriously in Norwegian Development Cooperation. So actually, so this year, NORAD and USAID has done a big push to get other donors to agree to what we call a donor statement on locally led development. That was actually just announced during the Global Partnership for Effective Development Cooperation. That's a mouthful. Summit in Geneva in the middle of December. The idea of that statement, right, is to get donors to agree on a set of core principles, basically, on how to do locally led development.
Okay, so this is different from, like, in Paris in 2015, it was more about donors coordinating their strategies. Mm. This one is how we could get much more local involvement?
Yeah, so in Busan, in Paris, and these so-called effectiveness criteria has always said that the locally led development is better than non-locally led development. But in contrast to, so in humanitarian aid, right, so sometimes we have this split between long-term development and humanitarian aid. In humanitarian aid, you have the grand bargain, which is a framework, a set of principles for how to operationalize, essentially, locally led development. We don't have that for long-term development. We have this overarching ambition or principle that locally led is better, but what that actually means in practice is less certain. So let's take an obvious example. So Norway channels around 60% of our development cooperation through multilateral agencies. So what does it mean when we say on the one hand that we are for locally led development, but at the same time we channel so much of our funding through multilateral organizations?
Right. The negotiating and bargaining power of countries vis-a-vis these powerful multilateral institutions is different.
Absolutely. And it's so even for Norway, the bargaining power in some of these organizations is quite small. So then you can think of what the bargaining power for Ghana is. So that means for NORAD and for Norway, if we're taking locally led development seriously, a core question for us will have to be, okay, so what does that mean for what we say to UNDP? The directives that we give to UNDP, the policies or the guidelines that our MFA take to the boardrooms of the UNDP and argue for how they should work. It's been a shift, definitely. You know, NORAD doesn't implement any of our own programs, in contrast to, for instance, GIZ in Germany or old DFID. We work through partners, and that means we're always at least one step, usually much more than one step, removed from the other countries, and that can make rhetoric and discussions about locally led development seem very abstract, very theoretical, and getting to grips what it actually means in practice. Yeah. That's the hard part.
I'm thinking about another concept that NORAD was talking about 20, 25 years ago, which was ownership, which a lot of donors still talk about. The question I have for you, Håvard, is when we talk about locally led development, it almost seems like if donors are talking about it, it's like donors are going to somehow facilitate this. That for me is something weird. I mean, if it has to come from below. So going back to the term ownership, if I believe in something, I'm a local elite and I'm really committed and I really want to, I have a vision and I want to push a certain agenda, I'm politically enthusiastic, I show a willingness, and then you come and you say, okay, you're impressed with my vision and we can do business together and you can maybe fund some of these efforts. But this presupposes, at least in my book, that it isn't process that is facilitated by donors. It comes from below or from within, from the national leadership. It also presupposes a political settlement that there is, as you may have heard one of my previous guests, Stefan Durkun, talks about the development bargain, that people agree in society that this is a way to go. So how does this square then, this ownership, this political enthusiasm, with what you and your colleagues at some of these other donor countries have thought about locally led development?
Well, you know, to be really honest, to some extent, it doesn't square. And that's part of the reason for why we, you know, so you mentioned local ownership. Whenever we talk about locally led development, you very quickly realize that we are having a lot of the same conversations over and over and over again. You know, we called it something else in the past, you know, it was local ownership or something like that. Now we call it locally led development. And, you know, so when we were at this DPEDC, which is the abbreviation summit in Geneva, we had a meeting among the Nordic countries that to some extent think quite similarly in terms of what locally led development means. You know, some nuances, but pretty similar. And we'd presented this donor statement to all of them. And the Finns were in the room. And the Finns, in contrast to some of our other Nordic neighbors, have a tendency to be honest, brutally honest, which can be refreshing. So they just asked point blank, isn't this the emperor's new clothes? What's actually new in this donor statement? And, you know, the truth, I think, is that there's not a lot of new things in that donor statement. There's a lot of old ideas in new framing or new clothing. And I don't think that's in itself is a problem, right? It's something about, you know, an idea whose time has come. Yeah. Maybe that's now. It's something about, you know, where you see momentum, where you see the windows of opportunity that can change over time. And I think there's a real window of opportunity now to do something differently with locally led development. But, you know, core to our thinking in this is what I think is originally a Samantha Power slogan of we have to shift the power, right? That means that we have to shift the power to local elites. And then again, shift the power is something that is very easy to say, but what does it actually mean in practice, right? It means that we have to take some of our power and give it to someone else. That's extremely hard to do for anyone, and especially maybe countries. It, you know, in practice, it might mean something like, you know, giving your seat at the table at an important multilateral gathering to a South-based representative instead. But I think if we're actually going to get anywhere with this agenda, it will have to involve filling this shift the power slogan with actual meaning. And I don't think we're there yet, but we're having at least good conversations, and then we'll see.
I think it is important sometimes to repeat something, to reiterate something. This is what the UN often does. And if you look at this, the first statement of anything, right? It's this, the first page is about we reiterate, we reaffirm. And sometimes if things are forgotten, it makes sense to talk about those things. Maybe there will be a subtle nuance. So I think this is a great move. I'm just curious as to how this will be operationalized in practice. And going back to how we started the conversation, it is that inherent tension that local elites may want something that you are not comfortable giving. How is that impasse resolved? I was thinking about another concept, Howard, at least one of those development, the jargon, the fashionable buzzword that we often like, empowerment. We talk about empowerment as in you empowering me in relation to my wife, but you don't often necessarily want to talk about how I'm empowered in relation to you, you the donor. So there's often this tendency I noticed that we're talking about ownership, empowerment in local society vis-a-vis local leaders, but this kind of international accountability, what are we doing? And can we be criticized, we as donors? I think that is also something I hope is discussed when one talks about local-led development.
No, absolutely. And, you know, this is a fascinating, not just question, but dilemma. So, you know, going back to Stefan Durkin's book on development bargain, you know, his, to strip it down to its core, Stefan basically says that if you're working in a country where the elites haven't agreed on a development bargain, you're wasting your time, you're wasting your money. I'm sure there's not a development bargain in all of the countries that we are working in. There are, you know, political infighting, and we often come with, you know, quite heavy normative agendas. One thing is around, you know, human rights, but also other issues related to equality, youth, female empowerment, etc., that are not uncontroversial. So how do we ensure that we don't, you know, simply take our ideas and impose them on other countries? That's you know, an inherent tension and dilemma. And how do we empower the elites that should be empowered because they've actually made a development bargain, empowering them instead of undermining them, which aid projects can also do in a worst case scenario. These are these dilemmas in development cooperation that it's extremely important that we are cognizant of. Yeah. It's dilemmas that I wish were, you know, a bigger part of the discussion around development cooperation in the Norwegian public and in every country's public, basically, but which we don't very often discuss. And, you know, which then tend to take a back seat instead of being, you know, front and center.
So one of the things I notice, Howard, is that the discourse, the global discourse on aid has become increasingly pessimistic, especially during the pandemic and also afterwards. Aid in the sense, aid coming from certain countries, the taxpayers often ask, why should we give free money? Or, you know, in terms of, say, cash transfers. We know, and we'll return to cash transfers. You know, the cash transfers work. But the very idea that we're going to give free money doling out to people, that's just something wrong. If we are to get money ourselves, that's fine. But to give our money to someone else, that's something wrong. So I noticed that we're trying to, not we, but you guys in the agencies, you're trying to make a more persuasive case to the taxpayer that whatever is provided in terms of support, whether it's aid or development cooperation, whatever, is effective. It works. And my personal experience, especially from Norway, is that you in the political scene, you would have certain politicians and their parties talking about or harping on perhaps the scandals or what doesn't work. And in that process, one stops talking about maybe 95% of the things that work. So I would like to hear your views on what you consider to be effective development aid. What works, not just in NORAD, Håvard, but what is effective aid?
So that's the million kroner or 40 billion yeah. Norwegian kroner, which is the aid budget question. So let me start in a slightly different start from a slightly different angle. So Statistics Norway, they do, I think every other year, they do a survey of Norwegians' attitudes to aid, development assistance. An extremely interesting picture emerges from that survey. On the one hand, support for development assistance in Norway is extremely high, around 90%, and it's increasing over time. People believe or support that we're spending a lot of money on development assistance. It is actually among one of the most popular program the state Norwegian government runs. It's basically development assistance and kindergartens. That's what the Norwegians love the most. But at the same time, this study also shows that a large and growing proportion of Norwegians don't believe that aid actually produces results, produces few or no results.
It's a contradiction.
It's absolutely a contradiction. I'm absolutely convinced that over time, those two figures can't trend in opposite direction. That is going to undermine support for development assistance. I'm also concerned that that means that actual support for development assistance in Norway is, what's the term, a mile wide and an inch deep, right? We saw that in Sweden now. So Sweden is going to cut their development assistance quite dramatically over the next few years. There was, you know, opposition in Sweden to that, but getting it through was quite easy for the government. Same has happened in
the
Denmark
UK.
And same has happened in the UK. Yeah. So that means we have to shore up support for development assistance.
And how much is this is because of lack of knowledge?
I think a lot of is a lack of knowledge. So, you know, when we talk about development assistance in Norway, the debate is almost only about the level of the aid budget.
Yes.
Right? We talk about how much money we spend. We don't talk at all as much as we should about what we spend it on. So the aid debates in Norway are either on we should spend more or we should spend less, or there's been some kind of scandal that frames a discussion. We hardly ever talk about, so what are the big aims we want to achieve? How do we achieve them? What is effective aid? But what we do know, right, from a big body of research is that there is a lot of aid that is extremely effective. And we also know that, you know, at a top level, there is a robust relationship between development assistance and economic development. And I think, you know, it's incumbent on us to tell that story and in an evidence-based and knowledge-based manner, right? To communicate to the Norwegian public about, you know, what is this development assistance actually achieving? How are we achieving it, and how could we do even better? And I think part of that story as well has to be that, you know, we're to some extent, we're all in this together. It has benefit for us that poor countries get richer. You know, then you get trading partners, you get markets, etc., etc., etc. It's not like this is simply money out of the, down the drain. We get something out of it. And we also get peace and stability out of it, which is definitely important.
I think some of the challenges of communicating that positive narrative is that, let's say the media is not interested in the success stories. It's almost like it's expected to work. So it's far more sensational to talk about what doesn't work. And that's what is ingrained in the brain of the reader that, oh, there's this one guy who's corrupt and he used aid money to buy a private jet and he's a bandit. And therefore, everyone else is like that. So I think it is extremely important. And I've tried to do this by developing a teaching module called What Works in Development, because I don't think we should be naive and just talk about the success stories. We should absolutely address the challenges, but we need to highlight what works. But in this context, however, I also think we have to be more honest, perhaps just like the Finns you were telling about. We should be open to talking about also the challenges. And I noticed that in the aid industry, not just in this country, but also elsewhere, there is this tendency of just not talking about what doesn't work. And one of the main reasons is the fear that this will create bad publicity. You may lose support among members who are contributing with money or from the government that is supporting you. And this is particularly, I suppose, a challenge for civil society organizations that you want to highlight, you know, the rosy picture. And in doing so, I think it creates a problem of legitimacy. So I'm just thinking that if you are a voter and you think, okay, I'm getting proper information, balanced information of what works and what doesn't, I may be more willing to be convinced that aid is effective.
Yeah. No, and that is an integral part of NORAD's mandate, right? Is to communicate in a knowledge-based, evidence-based manner about what works and what doesn't work. And be open and transparent about how we spend money, what we spend money on, what we achieve, and what we don't achieve. But, you know, as you say, whenever there's public debate, it's driven by scandals. It's also, you know, one thing I really, really would have wished for is, you know, so we have some really high quality, extremely professional civil society organizations in Norway that are big, you know, internationally in the aid industry. They have different ways of working. What I really would have wished is that every once in a while we had debates in the Norwegian public about, you know, what's the best way of doing it. Norwegian Church Aid is doing it in this manner. Norwegian Refugee Council is doing it in this way. What are the pros and cons? Why are you arguing that this is the best way of doing it? Why are you doing it in that way? I think that could be extremely good for debate.
That we've tried this once with your colleague, my current doctoral student, Nikolai. We wrote an op-ed piece about one particular kind of support that civil society organizations in Norway were receiving from NORAD, and that led to an uproar. How dare we even question that? So there are obviously vested interests in the aid industry. It could be academics, civil society, whatever. We don't want, you know, uncomfortable questions being asked. So I think that is one thing. The other one I was thinking about is also being exposed to new forms of doing, you know, this development cooperation. And one topic I know has got more attention now than before, and that has to do with the role of southern NGOs that have often argued that we take all the risks, we do all the work, and you guys in the north, the northern partners, get all the credit, get more money. It should be a more fair distribution of aid. And so is that something that aid agencies talk about, that rather than just channeling resources to multilateral institutions or our domestic NGOs, maybe we should give more money directly to people there in the field?
No, for sure. And, you know, this is going back to our discussion on locally led development. The question is, you know, how much do we channel through multilateral organizations? How much do we channel through Norwegian NGOs? How much is funded directly is, you know, key questions. And, you know, the Norwegian civil society organizations is always going to be a big and integral part of the Norwegian aid industry. You know, I think there's scope to do more what we call direct funding, you know, actually giving money directly to local, in the proper sense of the word, civil society organizations.
Why do you think we moved away from that, Robert? Why?
So, you know, the aid budget grew. NORAD and Norwegian aid had to go through a different modus operandi for grant management. We are now completely reliant on working through partners. the entire industry, and I don't mean industry with bad connotations, has, you know, professionalized a lot. Submitting an application to NORAD, going through all the hoops and ladders and chutes and ladders, qualifying, following up, result, reporting requirements, etc. That requires a really professional organization. There's a lot of local organizations don't have the capacity to get funding from us directly, which I think is a interesting dilemma in itself.
Because they may be doing very good work.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I think there's an extreme case to this. And this is, you know, we've mentioned cash transfers already, yeah. You know. Turns out, simply giving money directly to poor people is among the most effective forms of development assistance there is. But remember, when people started doing this, the argument was, no, you can't do that. They're gonna, you know, they're gonna waste the money. They'll be lazy. They're gonna, you know, they will booze and narcotics or whatever. Turns out, you know, surprise, surprise, they know what's best for themselves. And it now turns out that cash transfers, you know, they have. They don't just have immediate effect. They let people lift themselves, you know, pull themselves out of poverty long term. It has a host of, you know, indirect effects related to, you know, health, education. It even leads to local business development. You know, it leads to much more local business development than microcredit, which is quite interesting.
And less work for the donors.
Much less work. So, you know, and we have quite a lot of experience in Norwegian aid doing cash transfers in humanitarian settings. We have much less experience in long-term settings. Now we've gotten a directive from our MFA to do much more in long-term development settings. So that means, you know, it opens up a new chapter for us. What does this mean, right? Who are the partners that we're going to work with to accomplish this? What's the role of government? You know, Norway has a welfare state. Cash transfers is basically, you know, a welfare system. So do we help other countries build similar welfare states and then channel cash through them? Or how do we do it? That's interesting.
Yeah, mildly put. I mean, just if you think about a country that is Norway's donor darling, Malawi, they have some very good experience with unconditional universal cash transfers. And I've spoken about this with Ugo Gentilini, one of my previous guests from the World Bank, who leads the social protection team there in terms of cash transfers. Some of the challenges are the recruitment or the targeting criteria. Mm. How do we identify the ultra poor? How are we going to actually give the money in the absence of an ATM machine or a bank? Is it to be transported? Is it going to be based on, you know, mobile phone transfer? Then there's technology, etc. But I think cash transfers is actually a great case where one could, as a donor, do something about local ownership and some sort of a budget support, a hybrid form. You're not giving money directly to the government, but you can say, I'm giving money for this cash transfer program, which may or may not be projected as coming from the government. So the receivers don't need to necessarily know it is coming from Norway, right? And so if it is seen to be coming from the government, it boosts the legitimacy of the government, and it could lead to administrative or strengthening of administrative capacity. But sometimes I feel, Howard, some of these programs that work well, such as cash transfers, they presuppose that there is administrative capacity there. And to build that capacity for a government is much more long term. So, yes, it may work in some places, but when you try to replicate this in other contexts without that required infrastructure and capacity, then that becomes more of a challenge.
No, absolutely. And which is probably also the reason why big focus on cash transfers has been in humanitarian settings, where you don't, you know, you bracket the whole state capacity, long term development part. So that is when, you know, when we are developing our strategies around social safety nets, which we call it at NORAD, then the issue of how do we strengthen state capacity to deliver, to manage, is absolutely critical. And this has many facets. You know, it's things that we take for granted in Norway, like a census, a registry that you actually need to ensure that you target the ones that you target, that you reach the ones you want to reach. That has then to be part of the aid program to ensure that you build that capacity and not just, you know, send funding. And I think it's also, you know, for us, absolutely central, again, dilemma. We've talked a lot about different dilemmas to this is, you know, so many of the countries that we're working in now are, you know, the jargon word that I'm not a big fan of in development circles is nexus countries. You know, countries that at the same time both have, you know, humanitarian conflict crises and where we have long-term development projects. You know, it used to be that these were separate words, worlds. You know, you had countries that were undergoing conflict where the humanitarians were, and then the conflict ended, and then the long-term development people moved in. Now you have, you know, protracted crises, countries that move in and out of crises, and the humanitarian and the long-term is basically layered on top of each other. So that means that you can't have a humanitarian cash transfer program that just comes in, fixes the problem, and then moves out, because that might undermine long-term development. At the same time, as you know, the neutrality and everything that is so central to humanitarians has to be they has to be protected in a world where you, at the same time as you're doing humanitarian assistance, also you have to do long-term development.
This is a particular challenge, Howard, because in the aid world, one is often, at least traditionally, one has been obsessed with the exit strategy. You want a clear in and a clear out strategy. But when the exit is unclear because the humanitarian, the short term, merges into the long term need, then you're there forever. And that is more difficult to convince the taxpayer that you're going to. It's like, you know, being in Afghanistan for the Americans and you're stuck there and the taxpayers are saying, you know, come home.
Yeah.
And when you do decide to come home, everything collapses.
And, you know, this is why, you know, one part of this is it's always easier to make the case for humanitarian assistance because the needs are, you know, they're in your face.
Short term.
You know, you don't have to argue for effectiveness. It's, you know, this person needs food.
And it's also very visible, right?
Yeah,
so
extremely.
It's visible suffering and everybody says, oh, we have to, of course, there's no other way out.
Yeah, just do it. You know, even aid critics in Norway say they support humanitarian assistance. But, you know, so this problem with the, you know, the overlap of humanitarian and long term is only going to get worse. So the World Bank did a fascinating study where they showed, so in 2000, 80% of extremely poor in the world lived in politically stable countries, right? So the countries were stable, no conflict, but they had a lot of poverty. In 2030, according to projections from the World Bank, that picture is almost going to be flipped on its head, right? So in 2030, according to World Bank estimates, 2/3 of all extremely poor are going to live in conflict and fragile countries. So that means that we've gone from a world where the humanitarians had their set of countries and NORAD had its set of countries to, in 2030, it's going to be the same countries. And we have to create systems, create structures where we don't undermine each other, where we don't think long term, and where we actually are able to build, you know, capacity, sustainable development in some of these countries where, you know, building. Some of these countries are also countries where the regimes are, to put it diplomatically, hard to work with, right? Doing capacity building for the government of Mali is bordering on impossible for a donor such as Norway, which is, you know, where human rights are so central to what we're doing. So how do we then work to ensure long-term capacity? Well, civil society is obviously one avenue, right, to support. You can support civil society even in those countries, and civil society is going to be important also after the crisis has ended, at the same time as you have to always look at ways in which to support state capacity, since that's going to be what ensures long-term development.
So when we want to talk more about the positive story, convince our taxpayers that it should not just be about the money, how much money, or the percentage of GNI, but it should be more about effectiveness, things work, we need information. We need rigorous evaluations. And I know that you've been particularly interested in promoting rigorous randomized controlled trials, the gold standard from the medical field to figure out what works. But that is also many would say, not the only way of assessing effectiveness. We should use different techniques. Mm. It isn't just the RCTs. And we shouldn't rely on a rigorous... There are many things like political participation or empowerment that is very difficult to measure. What are your thoughts there in trying to uncover more knowledge about what works and using perhaps a whole variety of techniques to create that evidence?
No, that's a good question. I guess to some extent, I've almost been portrayed as a RCT
zealot
in Norwegian media, which is okay. No, so honestly, right? So I think there is absolutely scope to do much more high quality randomized controlled trials in Norwegian development aid to ensure that we do get, you know, really, really, really high quality information on what works and what doesn't work. Right, the what is really, really nice about an RCT is that it sometimes tells you, no, this didn't work. And what would be a dream scenario, right, is to get to a point where you're rewarded, you know, as a partner to Norwegian Development Aid, if you're rewarded for running an evaluation that shows that, oh, this thing that we thought would work really well doesn't work at all. We're not going to spend any more money on it. Let's do something else instead. I think a lot of our partners now would be absolutely terrified to notify NORAD that, no, turned out it didn't have any effect at all. So that, you know, getting to a point where failure is rewarded, right? And that's the
is that possible with an RCT?
It's to some extent, right? And it is, you know, we want innovation. We want to take risk. If we're serious about that, then we have to be serious about celebrating failure, making sure that that's not the end of the conversation with our partners, but the start of the conversation. So I want to make sure that where and when appropriate, we use RCTs to get that you know, quality knowledge. But RCTs will always only be, you know, a part of the puzzle. They are extremely good at what they're good at, and they're extremely poor at everything else, right? There's a lot of stuff that we want to achieve that is, you know, societal level changes where you have to do, you know, completely different forms of evaluations. There's long-term development that we want to see where an RCT is sometimes not feasible or appropriate at all. And then there's sometimes we have to understand much more deeply how the change happened. We want to understand much more deeply how it affects people. And this means basically that to get to a point where Norwegian development aid is much more knowledge-based than it is today, I'm not saying that it's not today, but I'm seeing there's scope, room for improvement, then we have to use the entire toolbox. I think the problem today is that 95%, maybe more, of the evaluation toolbox now is key informant interviews. There's room and scope for key informant interviews, but social science and the other sciences have, you know, they've developed so many other methods that are extremely good at what they do. So let's use them for what they're worth.
Yeah, I have to be honest that some of the evaluations that I have been not a part of, and I don't do evaluations, but I've read evaluation reports, among others, from NORAD. I've given advice, been part of a reference group. I've not always been very impressed. I feel that some of these evaluation firms have often just, it's a copy and paste. You have it depends on the terms of reference. They are also interested in making sure that if they are perhaps too critical, they may not get another contract. So it just seems to be, for me, it's like a circus. You want to be part of it and you write more of the same. And I do agree that you just can't do the key informant interviews. These are people with a stake in it. Who on earth was going to say, no, this one wasn't very successful? Unless you have a bone to pick with that, right? Yeah. If you were removed from the program, then you would say, this really was bad. So I think there's something about trying to find a way to get the evidence. And as you said, it is really important for our partners or whoever we work with, including us academics, if people could just say, you know what, I'm sorry, I wasn't able to do this, that, you know, we failed. It should not lead to total abandonment. It should lead to an honest conversation. In fact, I would be even more willing to work with a partner if they say, you know what, there were these reasons why we failed, but if only we address this, it'll work.
Yeah.
So I think evaluation is important, but I think the key thing that you just said is that maybe we don't often want to talk about that lest we lose what we have got.
Yeah. No, and I think, you know, to build long-term trust with the public that we're spending aid money well and it has effect, then we have to communicate honestly about both what works and what failed and why and how it failed. And then, you know, we have to be able to do that in a rigorous manner. And for that to be possible, it can't mean the end of the relationship between the donor and the partner.
Mm.
That's, you know, then we will never get that kind of information. And I think there's a, you know, so NORAD, so our NORAD's evaluation department actually did an evaluation of evaluations. So you can, you know, maybe we'll do an evaluation of evaluations of evaluations at some point. But anyway, so they evaluated all so-called program evaluations. You know, so you know, specific evaluations that are looking at a project or a program. There's dozens of them are conducted every year. And the result from that, or the findings from that evaluation of evaluations, is absolutely depressing. It is low quality, it is sloppy craftsmanship, to be honest, and there's recommendations and conclusion that are basically not connected to the empirics at all. But still, you know, we're spending quite a lot of money on all of these program evaluations, and it's to, you know, some of them are obviously good, but many of them, it's hard to see what they're giving us, and that they're definitely not telling us much about where we should spend the money or how we should spend the money differently, or, you know, what we should cut and what we should scale. And that's what we want to change now, right? We want to make sure that we have the kind of evaluation that we need and the kind of information and knowledge broadly that we need to say that, oh, okay, this is the stuff that we are now fairly certain works. We're going to continue doing that, maybe scaling it up. Here's a bunch of stuff that doesn't seem like it works at all. It's too hard to get to work. We're just going to cut it. Let someone else do that. And here is all of the stuff that we have high hopes for. It's innovative. We're not sure if it's going to pan out. It might be complete failures. But at least we're going to try, and we're going to evaluate it rigorously, and we're going to dump it if it fails, and we're going to scale it if it works.
As a donor agency, one has to be persuasive vis-a-vis the evaluators that one is interested in an honest evaluation, a critical, balanced, independent, just like us researchers.
Mm.
You know, it can't be a one-sided, it shouldn't be based on me giving you a positive rating because then you'll ask me again to rate you. I think one has to convince people that we are genuinely interested in the feedback.
Yep.
You know, it's not an exercise going through the motion, which brings me to the final set of issues. One has to do with how you moved smoothly from being a top-rated, excellent researcher at the Peace Research Institute in Oslo to this new position as the Director for Knowledge at NORAD. How that transition has been for you? I'm curious because I don't know if I'd be able to work in your position and not perhaps have the freedom that I have to say exactly what I wish. So that's one thing I'd like you to reflect on. And finally, how you see the future of the global development agenda. Now there's not so much talk about the SDGs. We have just a few years left. 2030 is fast approaching. A lot of us are talking about the post-2030 agenda. So firstly, how it has been for you to move between research and policy, and secondly, the future of global development as you see it.
It's been a fascinating and extremely interesting move. I think, you know, in Norway it's extremely rare, I guess, to go from, especially when you've been in research as long as I had been, to move out and go to policy.
Why did you make
that? You know, it's this push and pull factor. So, you know, I was extremely happy at Prio. I still think it was a fantastic job. You know, it was fascinating questions, amazing colleagues and everything. Then, you know, NORAD came along, you had this new strategy, you had a new director general of NORAD who kept saying, fakta ha makta, facts rule, or whatever you, however you want to...
He's been on the show and he's talked about that.
you know, he would say that every other sentence, and I got curious about what this means. And, you know, we had some conversations and I got convinced that, oh, maybe it's time to try something new. It would be fun to try something
new. I'm
glad
you did that.
Well, you know, I could take some of my research experience and use it for something else. But, you know, it's a completely different beast. Prio is a independent foundation, less than 100 employees. I woke up in the morning and I could basically do whatever I wanted that day. Talk to whoever I wanted, write about whatever I want. Yeah. Start whatever project I wanted, approach any donor I wanted, absolutely free reigns. Now I am at a agency that is part of a massive state bureaucracy, an agency that is, reports to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is a quite hierarchical structure.
You have to be careful.
You have to be.
A bit more careful.
I have to think much more carefully about, what kind of initiatives I pursue, how I anchor them in the organization, what I ask permission for doing, what I don't ask permission for doing. And I'm sure if you talk to Bo Vegar or some of my superiors in the MFA, they would say that the entrance has not always been frictionless. there's been missteps and there's been miscommunication and there's been stuff that's just completely not on my radar to think about, but which is important within a big bureaucracy. And we're also, we're trying to make quite big changes to how we work at NORAD. It doesn't mean that how we did things in the past was wrong. It means that we want to improve how things are done. And that's always hard, right? To change an organization, even when with an organization where everyone is enthusiastic about, the overall ambition, how you do it, how you operationalize it is always going to create frictions. And, I'm still finding my footing and figuring out how to navigate.
I think that could be a sobering experience, actually. Mm. Also, when you decide to come back to academia, I think for all of us, and this is something I miss in Norway, because like at Stanford, it was very common for people in academia to actually serve in the State Department and then to come back. Mm. I think that kind of experience from public admin is really good also when you come back and you don the hat of a researcher. Maybe it sobers us. Maybe it makes us more democratic, right? And less individualistic.
Yeah. I think you're right. And there's a lot of experiences that I've made already that I think will probably make me a better researcher. And I'm, at least I hope, that having my research background in NORAD as the organization is a plus to the organization. Yeah. And then, there's some obvious things that I think I knew, on a theoretical level before I started, but which I now, appreciate much more. And one thing is, how rushed every process is. You're used to in research, you have your time, you write an article, things
are...
The
literature review.
Yeah. But especially when you deal with the MFA and the closer you get to policymaking, the timeline is so compressed. Everything has to be, it's next day or 2 days at the very most for things that are big, big, big decisions. And, really appreciating that, I think would be useful for researchers.
So when we write the abstract, we should be better. Because some of your colleagues have told me that they only have time to read the abstract. So I realized that maybe I should, try and formulate as an attractive and abstract as possible.
Yeah, no, for sure.
But the final thing about the future of global development, as you see it.
Yeah. No, so I guess we've touched on some issues already. I think, this issue of the overlap between long-term and humanitarian conflict crises all happening in the same places is going to be absolutely defining for the next decade, two decades of development. Add to that climate change that's going to wreak havoc on many of the same countries. that they are today experiencing crises, conflict, and where the needs for long-term development are absolutely dire. Then you have big power rivalry, which is increasingly defining development as well. China is now a global actor. What the competition between China and the US looks like in the next 20 years, I'm not sure what it will look like, but that is going to be, you know, a major, it's going to a large extent set the scene and define the boundaries for what we as a fairly small development agency can actually do in many of these countries. Maybe we move to a new Cold War, I don't hope so, but that's going to be a completely different world. And then is, you know, this whole that we started with shift the power and locally led. It is simply not possible anymore to think that we are going to develop the South. It has to be development cooperation and actually figuring out what that means in practice, moving beyond the slogans. That is going to be key for the future of development cooperation. And then I think, you know, the SDGs have to a large extent served us really well. It gave us less focus than the Millennium Development Goals, but it broadened the agenda. It really emphasized this shared notion of it all. You know, we're all in the same boat. Yeah. Which I think is key. And you know, it's already now, I think the fact of the matter is that we're not gonna meet the SDGs. Not by 2030, maybe not even by 2040. So there's definitely going to be scope to continue working on the SDGs also after 2030. But I do hope that we have, you know, I think the process with the SDGs was, so the process of developing them was interesting. You know,
participatory.
Yeah. And in complete contrast to the MDGs, which I guess were basically thought of by Jeffrey Sachs in a back room at some point.
The basement of the UN building.
Yeah. So to continue that past participatory process in a, you know, structured and manageable manner, that I think would be interesting. And, you know, it's a kind of thing where when the UN does it well, it's really good at it.
Ava, it was wonderful to have you visit me today. Thanks for a wonderful, productive, informative conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Noel.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please spread the news among friends and colleagues and share the link to the podcast on social media. You can tag us on Twitter at GlobalDevPod and Dan Bannick.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Bannick from the University of Oslo Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.